Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be starting the second part of the forum. I hope you all had a nice lunch if you are here from the morning. And I think even if you don't have didn't have the time to have coffee or something to replenish, I'm sure you'll be all waking up sharp while you are listening to our another very interesting and exciting talk that is going to be that is being lined up. So we do have the pleasure of this connectivity panel. And before let me just briefly introduce the chair of the panel. We have the big pleasure of having Professor John Sider, who is the Sir Patrick Gillam Professor of International and Comparative Politics, affiliated with both the Department of Government and the Department of International Relations. John has been working a long time on the Philippines and also having pursued research on the politics of infrastructure and transport. And I think therefore we are in a very good hand when it comes to this connectivity panel on BRI and infrastructure. So I hand over the mic to John.
Many thanks, and welcome to this session, which will cover issues of connectivity with special reference to the so-called Belt and Road Initiative and its impact on different parts of Southeast Asia. We're lucky to have with us some very interesting and well-informed, impressive experts to share with us their views on these issues. So I'll briefly introduce them, and then they'll each give 10, 15-minute presentations, then we'll open up the floor to discussion, welcoming questions from the audience, and wrapping up 5 minutes after 3. So our first panel speaker is Professor Richard Griffiths, who's an emeritus professor at the Center for Innovation at Leiden University and also a fellow at the International Institute for Asian Studies. So he represents the great Dutch tradition of studying Southeast Asia. We have Dr. Gwani Lim, based at the Nanyang Center for Public Administration at Nanyang Technical University in Singapore. Just as Professor Griffiths is involved in overseeing an interdisciplinary research project on the impact of the Belt and Road Initiative in Southeast Asia and beyond. Likewise, we have in Dr. Gwani Lim, someone who's very active in researching on this topic in the region. And lastly, we have Dr. Champa Patel, the head of the Asia Pacific program at Chatham House here in London, who previously was responsible for Amnesty International's work across South and Southeast Asia. So we have three different sources and realms of expertise through which we will get different perspectives on the Belt and Road Initiative in Southeast Asia. And let's begin. Welcome, please, Professor Griffiths, and then we'll proceed onwards. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to start by begging a little bit of indulgence because I was under the illusion that we had 15 minutes for our presentations, not 10. I prepared something.
15, that's fine.
That's okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm going to look at today is ASEAN's connectivity, and within that, China's Belt and Road, and not the other way around. And that's partly illustrated by the picture you have up there, where the smaller picture you can see is the traditional map that the Chinese authorities have produced of the Belt and Road, with those cute little lines drawn in blue as showing where the Belt and Road is going to be created. And in the background, from a rather nice site called marinetraffic.com, the actual shipping movements that have been taken place one day last month, but this could have been taken one day last year, one day a decade ago, it would probably have shown the same thing. So I often wondered what those little squiggly blue lines actually meant in terms of the reality of the maritime Silk Road as it has been developing over the last 15 or 20 years. Now, since the panel was full of country experts, I decided to avoid countries altogether and go to the sea, and that way to hope to outflank you all. So I want to say a couple of things about improving connectivity. One way to improve connectivity is to build more infrastructure. And if you read the literature, you would think that's all that's happening. Roads, railways, pipelines, ports, stretching out across continents and stretching towards us. But of course, that's not the only way to improve connectivity. Another way to improve connectivity is to keep the goods actually moving. So when I did my work in my latest book on the new Silk Road, and looking at the trains that move from Europe to China, or China to Europe, before they introduced these China-Europe expresses, the goods train would, on average, spend one quarter of its time moving and three quarters of its time standing still. Once they got these throughputs, these trains that only had one customs unit, one customs document going through, priority treatment going through borders, then the reverse actually occurred. The trains kept moving three quarters of the time and only spent one quarter of their time standing still. So a lot of improving connectivity can actually come through logistics rather than infrastructural spending. And that's often ignored in the debates. So this is the picture then of the literature. Dark, isn't it? And then all of a sudden, in 2013, we have the announcement in September and October of China's Belt and Road policy. And oh my word, what a fabulous literature was generated since then. But it's crazy, guys. It is mad what we're doing. We're acting as though there was absolutely nothing before China's Belt and Road. Okay, China's made infrastructure very sexy, and for academics, you can score on it. But let's not pretend there was nothing there before. And in addition, we treat it as though there is nothing else besides China's Belt and Road. Nobody else is doing anything. We are transfixed. And there's nothing beyond China's Belt and Road except World War III, if you believe the American literature. Come on, guys. We're academics. How have we got ourselves trapped into this situation? And the answer is very simple. We shouldn't start looking at a policy. We shouldn't start saying, China has a policy, let's start talking about it and nothing else. We should be actually looking at what is the problem that China's policy is supposed to address. Is there a problem with infrastructure? Is there a problem with connectivity? And what is it? And if we were to have done that, we would have had a rather different literature and hopefully some of it a bit more interesting than the endless political realism that's generated by American commentators on China's Belt and Road. So, having got that off my chest, move up there. So, I'm going to start with ASEAN connectivity, which, of course, began discussion of way before 2013. ASEAN Connectivity Conference, or was put forward 2009, and the ASEAN Connectivity Master Plan produced in 2014. But already in 2010, the major approaches of ASEAN's approach to connectivity were clear. The objects were to improve inter-regional trade and global competitiveness. And I think I ought to put my own glasses on. So I've not got my reading glasses on, so it's a bit tricky reading my own stuff. And first thing they said was, right, we're going to complete the Asian Highway, that is a UNESCAP project, and the ASEAN says, okay, we're going to fill in the missing links. Most of those are in Myanmar, there's about 200 kilometers missing, and we're going to upgrade the substandard roads. So that is an ASEAN plan. It is not a Belt and Road plan. It is not a Chinese plan, conceived by ASEAN for ASEAN. In addition, they said they were going to complete the Singapore Kunming Railway. Why is China wanting to build a railway? Because it's in ASEAN's connectivity plan. It's not that China's come along and said, oh, Kunming wants to link up with Singapore. It was done ages before, 4,000 kilometers of railway, done already there in advance and on paper. Here you see, 2010, the diagram of that railroad. Interesting, if you look, it does not go through Laos. Come back to that in a minute. So the Kunming-Singapore Railway is an ASEAN plan, not a BRI plan. And they're going to improve maritime connectivity, and for that end, also in 2010, they designated 47 ports which were going to get their attention and they were going to concentrate on. In other words, there was quite clearly life in ASEAN connectivity long before China arrived on the scene. Whew. Everybody happy? Good. So let's have a look then at ASEAN infrastructure. Now, the Asian Development Bank had published two studies, one before China's Belt and Road was announced, but the most recent one, making as Asian's infrastructure, or meeting Asian infrastructure needs, dated from 2 years ago. And they argued that for ASEAN, so I've taken the ASEAN figures out, they would need about, $200 billion a year in infrastructure. But 10% of that, 50% of that, will be just replacement infrastructure anyway. And basically, they estimated the current capacity was to pay for about half of it. So half would have to be met by foreign loans, by international development agencies, and by private, public-private partnership. This, of course, is assuming that countries grow in the interval, and that they will meet climate change regulations, or actually diminish the impact of climate change. Where was it needed? Well, ASEAN, or Asian Development Bank, said for all of Asia, most of it had to go into power and transport 32%. Now, when I contacted them on the phone and said, can you give me a breakdown of that, or also between countries, the answer was no. This is all from rather basic input-output analysis that economists like to do. So they took a series of estimates, put them together and said, look, this is what other people have estimated of the needs. And you'll notice that power now has dropped to about 40%, transport now well above 50%, mostly on roads and railway, very little on ports. Missing from this analysis, however, are Indonesia and the Philippines, which I'm sure would have pushed up the port element in the total. Now, if you look at ASEAN's international trade, you see a mismatch here between the amount of investment designated for port improvement and the actual amount of international trade that comes through the Maritime Silk Road. Almost 90% of ASEAN's international trade goes by sea. And yet very little of its transport infrastructure seems to be focused on the ports. So there's a basic mismatch there, and it's that mismatch that I want to discuss with you a little bit further. Let's start with the overland infrastructure first. I like overland infrastructure, but you have to remember the loans aren't just coming from China. I've just worked my way through last week through the Asian Development Bank and World Bank databases, and since January 2014, they have initiated projects worth $4 billion in road building alone to ASEAN countries. That does not include the projects that were already ongoing and initiated before January 2014. We have to put that into the picture. My recent book does exactly that. Yeah, I think, yeah, we might come to an agreement on that. If we look at railways, I've said that railways are in the Kunming-Singapore, is already there. The first railway line is drawn then through Laos. The next one has just been approved from Bangkok, heading east. That one, of course, funded by the Thai, but going to be built by the Chinese. And my question is, well, twofold. One, Laos is the least favorable route chosen by ASEAN itself, and yet it happens to be the route that the Chinese investment is going through. My second one, and this has to do with the sequence of infrastructure building, I don't think that that railway is going to do anything profitable until it links up to the ports around Bangkok, and I don't see the Thai government anytime soon building that railroad up to link up to Vientiane. Then down the bottom, we have the east-west part of the East Coast Railway in Malaysia. Malaysia's going to build it up. I wouldn't do it. I don't see the Thais building their railway down in any particular speed heading towards Malaysia, so I certainly wouldn't be tempted to do that myself. And then you have right at the bottom the suspension of the Kuala Lumpur-Singapore Railroad, which, to be honest, is the only one that makes any sort of economic sense. It's one of the densest air routes in the world, and that's suspended because, well, at the moment, Malaysia said it can't afford it, but if they could, Singapore would rather have the Japanese build it than the Chinese, so they have to sort that out. Sequence is important, then, in overland infrastructure. But that's not what I'm going to look at. I want to look very quickly at maritime infrastructure. One thing that's happened is the fleet, the ASEAN fleet, has increased by almost half in the last 4 or 5 years. If we'd taken that into account, and none of that's funded by China, that would be an investment conservatively of about $12 to $13 billion, just increasing that size of the fleet, far in excess of the amount of money we're looking at that's spent on land infrastructure. The port throughput's increased by about 20%. Taking a conservative estimate and calculating that, that's another $18 billion in ASEAN port improvement that's come. Very little of that by China. Jakarta being improved by the Japanese, for example, a lot of port authorities dealing with it themselves. That is a huge amount of infrastructural spending that is not on land. In addition, plans have been announced for a further expansion which, if I say if about 60% are realised, again, is another $15 billion going to be ploughed into ports over the next 20 years. So, basically, the problem is this is at a time when there is a huge overcapacity in Southeast Asian ports. So, why are they doing it? If you would give me 2 extra minutes, otherwise I will skip my... all of this, which skip, fair enough, done. You can ask me that at question time. So what is the role of China in all of this? How big is China's role in the Belt and Road? China's role in world trade's number one. It's the biggest world trade as a country. 11% of international trade, merchandise trade, is Chinese. It's only number three, though, in terms of world container ports. We know an awful lot about container ports. And we've been able to see the expansion, the cost of China's investment in overseas port capacity, $6 billion. I can go through the size of the fleet, but basically the size of China's fleet has increased by about $10 billion as well. So that is, again, a whole maritime investment that's not visible on the land infrastructure. So basically, my conclusions would be very simple. The Maritime Silk Road exists and existed long before China took part in it. China is taking part of it. It's big, but it's not overwhelmingly big. And if anything, it is catching up with its actual role in world maritime trade. China then is doing what all the rest of us have been doing all along. If we want to criticize it, I think we have to be specific and say, why is China different? Why is China worse? Rather than start with the assumption that it is different, that it is worse, and it is the only act in town, because it isn't. So, thank you very much. Seeing your life training away in
there's
front
a watch
of you.
Here. Oh, is yours, is it?
Yeah, there's mine. You can borrow it if you like.
15 minutes, yeah? Oh, okay. Look, firstly, thank you, Professor Shin, and your wonderful team, Lee and colleagues. Thank you for inviting us here and doing all the logistics. It's actually quite difficult and stuff like that, so thanks a lot. And yeah, thank you for inviting me to this panel. And yes, I'm presenting on that, and it has a lot of overlap with Professor Griffiths. And yes, is China buying up Southeast Asia? I think you know that the answer is no, right? The way I frame the question, yeah. It's just like your partner saying, hey, am I X or am I Y? You know, the best answer is no, or I'm not sure, right? Anyway, the roadmap is this. Arranged like a normal technical paper, because that's the only way I know it. But the interesting part is the analysis part, where we look at quantitative dimensions and the qualitative dimensions. And then we look back into history to give us some perspective, right? And the last part, I just threw it in, US-China relations, just for fun, right? Okay, the main puzzle is this. Is China buying up Southeast Asia through its TNCs? And, you know, to prove or test that argument, that hypothesis, right, then you need to know the value. And you have to compare it to the traditional investors of the region, the Japans, the EU28s and stuff like that, and where or which industries are the money going to, and, you know, how is it impacting regional economic architecture. So the summary is this. The main argument is this. It's actually a lot smaller than what, you know, newspaper tabloid suggests. And, you know, yes, it is increasing, but really the quantum is actually quite small, and it's not bigger than ASEAN investors or Japanese investors. And the quality is not great, right? It enters into very speculative industries, which we will show in a moment's time. Okay, the background is that if you wind back in time 6 years ago, right, back to the future, right, you know, people were generally happy, people were shaking hands, hugging each other, and like, yes, this is the time to kickstart our industrial revolution 4.0. Never mind that we were not sure of what 3.0 was. And, you know, there was this really happy mood, you know. I mean, if you look at Malaysia, we had the previous prime minister, he was really happy at the time. Not so happy now. But the point is, then it quickly turned. It turned sour, right? You have people like Mahathir Mohamad in his second tenure. This is back to the future again. And, you know, there was this fear that China was buying up the world. You know, debt trap diplomacy and stuff like that, and things happening in Sri Lanka being transposed back into the region. And how much of this is true? And if you look at Mahathir Mohamad, when he went to Beijing, he's been to Beijing a few times, but when he was in Beijing on August 2018, this is what he said. Poor choice of words, I think, you know, but since then, the whole thing has renegotiated, and, you know, he seems to be a happy man again. He's 94 years old. And really, if you look at Mahathir, you know, look at him. He was a China advocate in his first tenure, right, when he still had black hair and stuff like that. And he became a China basher when he was opposition for, I think, 6 months. And then he became China advocate again, right? And key projects targeted, which was mentioned by Professor Griffiths previously, the East Coast Rail Link, right? There are two versions of it. So which one do you want to believe? And there are seeming victories. So these are the noise, right? So what's behind the noise? What's the crux of the matter? Yeah. So we have to look at the numbers. We are numbers. You are like a castle. We are doors. What was that huge Sluice Gate? Yeah, the huge Sluice Gate, right? You have to defend yourself with numbers. So if you look at how we're going to do it, it's quantity, quality, and compare it against Japan and ASEAN investors. Those are the two big boys. So, yes, orange China, right? Orange line is low. It's increasing, yes, but it's low. It's not more than the other two lines. It's not very clear to you, but if you look at Laos, right? Laos is above Malaysia, right? You know, Laos is above Malaysia, and all these data are from ASEAN stats, unless otherwise stated. So if you look at Laos, right, this is the only case where the Chinese money outinvests the Japanese and ASEAN money, right? It is only in Laos. And Laos is the second smallest economy, right? Smallest is Brunei, but, you know, Laos is the second smallest. So if you look at the red ones, which is, I better look at my screen, Indonesia, Myanmar, and Singapore, the red ones, that's where most of the Chinese money has gone into, and they have not out-invested the regional investors, right? You still cannot beat Mitsubishi or, you know, CapitaLand, right, or Khazanah. So if you, that was the flow of foreign direct investment. So if you look at the stock, stock becomes a bit difficult because you really have to go through all the data, right? And it was not easy, you know. And, you know, I only had three countries because the rest I cannot read the local languages and I don't have enough data, but these three are legit. So, no, the Chinese are not winning. The Chinese are not buying up more than you, more than Japan or ASEAN is buying up. And if you look at Thailand, it's very stark, right? Because the difference is almost 20 times China and Japan, the latest stock in 2017. So that tells you how paranoid the mass media is, or some of us are, right? And if you look at the qualitative dimension, the story becomes even more jarring, right? So, sector by sector analysis, again, you can't really see, right? Anyway, Chinese investors, just look at the red circle popping up, right? It goes to real estate construction, right? And it tends to be very speculative, very chunky, and very controversial. Just ask Mahathir, right? And the next best one goes to financial and insurance activities. Okay, I can more or less neglect this for a while. And the third one goes to wholesale and retail trade. Then only it goes to manufacturing, right? And manufacturing being low is not so great for the Southeast Asian economies because, you know, the best way to hire people is through a factory, right? Not through a bank or a university, right? That's the best way, you know. And if you look at Southeast Asia, where do we put our money at? Manufacturing first. We're not great in manufacturing, yet we still go to manufacturing, you see. And then it goes to financial and, what's that? Professional, scientific, and technical activities. Services. Then only it goes to construction and real estate. Now look at Japan, the head goose, right? Most of the money goes to manufacturing, as high as about 40%. And I don't have the rest of the data here because ASEAN just only gave me their old data 2 days ago. But I can tell you that Taiwan, Korea, Japan, they all invest heavily in manufacturing when they come to ASEAN, except China. I don't know why, right? I never understood why. I have to do some research on that. But the Japanese put a lot of money in manufacturing, then only it goes to real estate. And the quantum is actually quite big, the margin. So historically, I mean, if you say, oh, that you're comparing current day Japan to current day China, you should compare Japan when it was less advanced. And this is where it becomes very interesting. If you look at the highest role, or the third highest role, basically, right, manufacturing. It's more than 50%, 60%, 70% in the old ASEAN, in the mature Southeast Asia. So for this one, you know, you can't argue against that. You cannot argue against that. So the conclusion is this, you know, Chinese FDI is a lot smaller than what popular rhetoric suggests. And yes, it's increasing in value, but not more than the old boys, the old players, the old money, right? Only case of success, Laos, that's it. And quality, not too great. And when it's not too great, it tends to be not too great for local development. When you need factories, all you get is luxury condos, probably not so good. And implications for US-PRC relations, all is good, nothing to worry about. Because if you look at red line is not higher than a lot of lines. Although I think US line is, I think that's self-inflicted. The last year it dropped, right? But I think that much is self-inflicted. But other than that, it out-invests China. So, you know, US position, in fact, EU28 position, right? Japan position is not as weak as commonly portrayed. You know, and the reality is that all of these TNCs they had first mover advantage. They build up incumbency effect. And when you build up incumbency effect, the Chinese firms, even if they want to come, they can't come, right? When you're using Japanese standard, why should I change to Chinese standard? Maybe 5G will be different, but it's too early to tell. So implications is this. Small Southeast Asian states, right? We're actually not as weak as commonly portrayed. We're actually quite savvy. I mean, you look at Malaysia and Thailand. The Thai ambassador has left, so I can say this very, very comfortably. We have held our own cooperated against or with Western Japanese TNCs for as long as I can remember. You know, what's the drink that you drink when you're in Malaysia when you're growing up? It's Milo. Milo is from the Netherlands, right? Coca-Cola is from the States. And they've built up incumbencies for several decades, right? And they are very entrenched. Automobile industry, Japanese castle. You cannot touch that. And, you know, very open economies on paper, like Malaysia, they're not actually very open. A good example is there is this state in Malaysia that has a few million people, but the funny thing is that only one company can sell sand and dredge sand. Yeah, I wonder why. I never understood why. Yeah, and the key industries tend to be controlled by politicians, state-owned enterprises, you know, well-connected, well-capitalized family firms. The Lim Xiao Liangs, the Lim Gotongs, no, they're not related to me, but yeah. They tend to be controlled by people like that. And, you know, Chinese firms, they're latecomers. Latecomers means what? You have to pay tuition fee, law. You pay a lot some more, and you may not get your returns back. And you meet someone like Mahathir, and he plays you out twice, right? At least, right? I mean, that's the reality, right? If you look at East Coast Railing and something like that. So, yeah, thank you. If you want this paper, please put down your hand. If you don't want the paper, also please put down your hand, right?
The joy of going last is that you can claim everything you wanted to say has already been said. So with that caveat, I'd like to say everything I was going to say has already been said, so hopefully this will be short. And I just want to reassure people I haven't accidentally walked into the wrong conference, because actually, and I haven't accidentally expanded ASEAN membership either, because I'm here to talk about Sri Lanka. So these are some of the lessons that I think can be learned from looking at Chinese investment, outbound investment in Sri Lanka, that can help us think through some of what we're seeing in Southeast Asia. And I absolutely agree with Richard. There's a lot of opinion masquerading as analysis when it comes to looking at Chinese outbound investment. You know, you could go so far as to say a lot is just drivel adding to the noise. But there's a lack of real evidence-based analysis that's out there to rebut some of these kind of narratives that are really dominant. They're much more around geopolitics rather than economic realities. So I want to start off with telling you two stories. There were two headlines in two publications, one from the East, one from the West. The New York Times in 2017, how China got Sri Lanka to cough up a port. And The Diplomat in 2018, is Sri Lanka really a victim of China's debt trap? And I think that poses the polarities that we're dealing with when we look at how do we understand Chinese economic engagement outside of its own borders. The reality is that if you look at the value of Sri Lankan debt to China, so if you strip away all of the sort of noise that's made about debt trap, debt diplomacy, Sri Lanka is subject to Chinese whims, what we do when we foster narratives like that is that we take away state agency. And we don't recognize, and I think the fallacy of such an approach is that you don't recognize the weaknesses of the state, but also what the state can do to be more resilient and negotiate better deals for itself. Because if the idea is that an external actor can just impose themselves on a country like this, then what we do is deny the country to be able to play a role in its own sort of narratives. So the value of Sri Lankan debt to China has doubled from $2.2 billion to $5 billion between 2012 and 2018. As a percentage of GDP, this is an increase from 3.2% to 5.6%. But Sri Lanka owes less to China than other foreign sources. 18.2% is owed to external financial markets, 8.9% to multilateral lenders and 6.3% to other bilateral lenders. This is important because if we talk about China imposing a debt trap, then how do we understand then all the other debt that they hold? So what you have in Sri Lanka are macroeconomic failures at a structural level that are not just about China. Now, that's not to say, because one should be critical in both directions, that China may not be taking advantage of this, but it was certainly not created by China. There's some data that suggests that actually Sri Lanka owes more to Japan in total sum. I think it's interesting what others were saying, because when you only look at like Chinese engagement in Sri Lanka, Chinese engagement in ASEAN countries, the problem is then you are blind to all the other actors that a state has to navigate. So any country, if you center it at the position of your analysis, will be negotiating investments from China, Japan, multilateral lenders, other bilateral donors. And then it's what is the state's capacity to negotiate all of these deals and the impact on the state. So I think there's a real fallacy in looking at it in a bilateral direction without recognizing the multiplicity of other actors involved. One area where I do think there are issues around trade deficits, and again, others, I don't know if others have touched on this, so maybe this is something I can claim for myself. but again, it's a much more nuanced picture than people would think. So yes, there is a trade deficit, for example, between Sri Lanka and China. This is true of many ASEAN countries and China as well. But in Sri Lanka's case, this is in part because of established long-term buyer-seller agreements between Chinese SOEs in Sri Lanka and suppliers in China, heavy state subsidies to heavily protected suppliers, but also a lack of a capital goods industry in Sri Lanka. So I think it's important to understand that, again, there's a different side to this that we need to factor into our analysis. A trade deficit has risen from 25% to 40% between 2006 and 2019 between Sri Lanka and China. However, and I think you touched on this, one of the upsides of the US-China trade dispute has seen China buying more from alternative markets, and many Southeast Asian countries have benefited from this, and this is true also of South Asia. However, there are issues, and again, I would say a lot of this lies with the state, not just with the Chinese engagement with the state. And these are sort of, broadly, I would cluster as governance issues. So I'm just going to run through these briefly. So I think the issue that you have is, again, if you only look at Chinese outbound investment and say it's predatory capitalism, etc., how do we then understand political elites or authoritarian regimes in some of these countries? So, for example, if you look at Sri Lanka, it was the Rajapaksa regime that negotiated a lot of these deals. If you go to, I don't know if people have been to Sri Lanka, but essentially it's like a lot of white elephant projects, a lot of vanity projects, all named after the former president. But if the, you know, the Chinese state preference is to negotiate state to state, and the state of recipient state is an authoritarian regime, which may be corrupt, may have vested interests, then how much can you blame China for that without also then looking at the fact that you have corrupt political elites that are taking advantage of this situation? So Rajapaksa secured $8 billion worth of loans, mainly for vanity projects bearing his name, including the world's emptiest airport, which only has one airline flying in and out of it, in Habantota, his ancestral home. But there are issues there around public information, transparency, that apply to all the different countries in which China wishes to set up projects. On what basis, for example, did General Prayut negotiate a rail deal between Thailand and China recently? What are the details of the deal? What are the cost-benefit considerations? The lack of transparency and public accountability poses issues then, whether it's around corruption, divestment of assets, etc., that can't adequately be controlled. I mean, I guess the classic example of that was Malaysia under Najib. And I guess Najib is from the Rajapaksa school of, you know, corrupt benevolence. But even I would argue with Martia 2.0, how much has actually changed? I think Martia played a very clever game of saying, you know, this is a new form of colonialism. We're going to suspend these loans. We're going to renegotiate them. But how much did the detail actually change? So I think, in a way, I think he leveraged the situation of being able to come back into power to secure better deals. But are they really optimum conditions? I think is still questionable. The other issue, often with recipient countries, is whether they have the negotiation capacity and legal due process that can allow them to secure better deals for themselves. For example, in Sri Lanka, there is no clear process for approving unregulated investments. I'm talking about whether it's tenders, feasibility studies, environmental impact assessments, or any approvals by cabinet. So again, it's very hard then to be able to penetrate that in order to make sure that there are better deals that are negotiated that can suit a country's development needs. And often, you know, if you look at some of the projects that are funded, how much of that was really based on need? How much was on an identified evidence base that said this railway is needed, this port development is needed? And I think that lack of an evidence base that's in the public domain then leads to these projects that are hugely expensive but don't actually contribute much for the people they're meant to serve. Now, in Indonesia, I mean, I guess people could argue that infrastructure developments are overly long, complicated, prone to delays, etc. But you could argue having such a consultative process at least presents some checks and balances. Not ideal, but it means that it can't be just signed off from the state to the state. But also in Indonesia, what you see is the country exercised competition as a leverage to secure better terms. So the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed railway was won by China because it didn't impose a debt guarantee. So I think this is where we have to understand the interplay of other actors, particularly Japan, which I'm always surprised by how much people overlook. And we did an analysis of Chinese contracts and Japanese contracts in Sri Lanka, and I think people would be really surprised at how similar they are. There's very little that differentiates these contracts, even down to some contracts where they say use of Japanese materials and goods. So I think if we're going to be critical of China, we also need to be critical of how other actors operate in this space. And I think the biggest one that you often hear a lot of criticism against China is around sovereign control. But there are other actors in this space that seem to get away with a lot because nobody's looking at what they're doing. So, for example, one of the key issues raised about China is divestment of national assets or foreign control of defense assets, Habantota Port, Matala Airport, Lotus Tower telecoms project in Sri Lanka, for example. Lots of concern about the dual Habantota Port, but much less attention on what other countries are doing. So did you guys know that the US wanted to also lease land on in Sri Lanka? Did anybody hear about that outside of the kind of main, the local coverage in Sri Lanka? It's called the Status of Forces Agreement between Sri Lanka and the US. Basically, according to a leaked copy of the draft, the US want to have, this is regarding ship visits, training, exercises, humanitarian activities and other activities, so not diplomatic activities. What they wanted was full immunity. They wanted to be able to wear uniforms and carry arms while on Sri Lankan land. They wanted US identification to be sufficient for entry and exit from Sri Lanka, so no need for Sri Lankan visas. And they wanted US vessels, vehicles, and aircraft to exit and move freely within the territory of Sri Lanka and be free from boarding and inspection by Sri Lankan security personnel. So if we're going to talk about the China is taking over Habantota Port, it's a dual-use port, there are things we should be worried about, then there should be equal amount of scrutiny of some of the leasing arrangements that the US is trying to secure that arguably also undermine sovereign control. The other area where I think things are problematic, though, and this, again, goes to your point, I think you have to really distinguish where is China distinct, where is it engaging in behaviors that arguably other countries are, and what is it doing that's different that needs to be scrutinized in more detail. And one area might be the development of separate legal systems. So if you look at Colombo Port City in Sri Lanka, it's the largest single foreign direct investment that Sri Lanka has ever had. It's basically creating a new mainland to accompany old Colombo. The new contract has not been released to the public, but the Chinese investors have been given favorable tax rates and business-friendly regulations. It's also supposed to operate under a British-style legal system that's different to the mainland. And it's also unclear what power China Harbor will have in the territory, whether it's essentially a landlord or whether it's subject to Sri Lankan law as it currently stands. So I think that should be an area where we should be concerned about, where a sovereign state hands over legal control over aspects of its territory to another state. But I think if we're going to say that, you know, we're worried about the security dimensions, then I think there are a lot of other actors that come into play that, frankly, at the moment are getting away with it because we're happy to, like, you know, pin the tail on the, well, China, I guess. I'll leave it there, but just to say a few closing remarks, just to reiterate again, I think when looking at Chinese outbound investment in Southeast Asia or Asia more broadly, a few things I think or have already been mentioned. One is it long predates BRI. A lot of the projects that are happening in Sri Lanka, the vast majority are pre-2013. Even Habantota Port was agreed before BRI was announced, then rebadged as BRI. So I think in a way the language is not very useful because it comes with a set of assumptions and it comes with its kind of political narrative that clouds the eyes from being able to do proper analysis. So in a way, our preferred usage in the research we're doing is to look at Chinese outbound investment and look at a range of instruments. So in a, it's not trying to sidestep the BRI analysis, but it's parking it because using that as a framework is not particularly useful in the sense that it comes with so much heat and not that much kind of dispassionate analysis. And then I guess the other, if there's one thing that makes South Asia unique that is probably different to Southeast Asia, is that it doesn't have a regional hegemon, although the Indonesians might think differently, such as India. So I think for the countries in South Asia, the appeal of China is that it helps to curb India. So again, I think you have to center state agency in this because small countries, and I've seen this with Chinese engagement in the Pacific Islands, leverage competition to suit their own needs. I'm not saying they get the best possible terms, but certainly what you've seen in the Pacific Islands, what you've seen in countries in South Asia, is where they will give, you know, one part of a railway to the Chinese, the other part to the Japanese, then get the Brits and somebody else to fight over something else. So I think, you know, we have to center countries as agents. We have to center them and understand the variety of relationships that they hold, and then understand China in that context. And then we can see what makes China unique or distinct, but also genuinely then, where are the issues that really need to be looked at and tackled?
Many thanks to our three speakers, all of who provided very appealingly contrarian accounts of the Belt and Road Initiative and its actual operations and different perspectives on Southeast Asia from within and beyond, and caveats and qualifications of previous understandings of developments and trends. Let's open up the floor to audience questions, and I mean audience questions rather than more presentations. So let's bundle up these questions, get three or four questions, and then get some answers from the audience. If you could identify from our speakers, if you could identify yourself, articulate a question, and any particular member of the panel you'd like to address it to, I'd be grateful. So just raise your hands. We have someone over here.
Hi, I'm Anna from KCL. I'm doing a master's in global affairs. And I have a question for Dr. Guani Lim, but like I'm welcome to for the rest of the panel to share their wisdom as well. So my question is that should Japan and the rest of the East Asian tigers should get more involved than in using economics to prevent more vulnerable nations of Southeast Asia into the arms of China and Russia, because the big disadvantage is that, especially in human rights context, China holds the veto power of the Security Council, which neither Japan nor any of the East Asian tigers do. So should they be more explicit in the diplomatic involvement in the international scene, or should they continue to be implicit as what it seems to be at the moment? Because you said China's not as overwhelming as the mass media make it seem to be at the moment, but would we, especially as ASEAN nations, be in danger of underestimating it then and being just relaxed then, like, say, saying, oh, Japan's got our back?
One, those two in the middle.
Thank you very much for some really interesting presentations. I'm Matt Phillips from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Two questions. The first one is, the presentation with the numbers, those are very interesting. And I'm sort of broadly aware, very aware of the fact that the numbers in terms of Chinese investment is relatively small. I do think it's important to recognize, though, that those numbers, small percentages, can mean a lot in terms of their real life effect. So real estate might not fit within the traditional picture of FDI into Southeast Asia, but in fact, that 1%, whatever that figure was, can have a significant effect on the people's lives in Phnom Penh, for example, or in Sihanoukville, or in other places where that real estate really is changing people's lives in dramatic ways. And I think that kind of speaks more broadly to the fact that, you know, I think we need to look at those figures. The fact that the ASEAN and Japanese figures in many ways marry up is significant, as is the fact that the Chinese investment is quite different. And so different investment creates different outcomes. I think that's really important. The second point/question is related to this issue of ASEAN being able to really sort of look after its own interests and that it has a long-term plan. I think that's absolutely correct. Thailand and Malaysia in particular, countries which are in a position to protect their interests, whether that's the corporate elites or whether that's national governments. But again, it gets back to the question from the previous question about how does ASEAN protect the interests of smaller nations? So, I think thinking about Laos, although it's has a very small percentage of GDP in terms of ASEAN, is really important because that's where that's where change is happening. So how can Laos be brought into that Southeast Asian context when primary focus, it appears to me, of Thailand, Malaysia, etc., is its own national interests for good reason.
And then there's a question there.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Maybe not a question, just a comment. Because I have run a country this year to investigate the BRI project in Southeast Asia. So I have some comment of the presentation. First, maybe the China, just like a dragon, mean the Eastern, a dragon is a positive animal, but in the Western, maybe just a negative animal. So how to see, how to root China's investment in overseas maybe depend on who has it there. So for example, we have investigation in Vietnam. You know that the Samsung Group, Samsung company that is in the Korea Gant, whose contribution to the Vietnam GDP is about 27%. But no one said that Korea should buy up the Vietnam. So that's the first one. The second one, we maybe should concern about the demand, the relationship between the demand and supply. For the demand, why China investment the infrastructure in Southeast Asia? Why China don't to investment in the UK or the Europe? Because the UK or Europe did not to need the infrastructure. Yeah. So this, I think, maybe it's the demand, or also the Asian needs to the infrastructure to build up. And another one, because the supply. Why China investment the infrastructure in Southeast Asia? We should know that why the USA want to instruct the investment in structure in Southeast Asia. Because we should know that China good at the construction. You know, China have a lot of railway, a lot of the road, so they good at the construction of the infrastructure. So we have to push the investment in overseas, just like that, good there. So this, I think, this is very important between the demand and supply relationship. The third one, in different, okay, very short, because the first stage meant China to invest in the infrastructure, but now, because of the US and China trade war, so a lot of manufacturer that transfer into the Southeast Asia, for example, Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, a lot of them. So now this manufacturer is done. The last one may be that China is certainly less of the experience overseas investment. So maybe a lot of things to learn. Okay, thank you.
Any question up here in the front, please?
And then, I also have a question at the back.
And then we'll get some responses, and then we'll have a second round.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. So my question is for Dr. Lim and Dr. Patel. So I'm reflecting for Indonesian case as you basically debunked the myth about the China FDI, right? And in Indonesia also there is
Yes.
Okay, it would be good if you were louder and speak a bit slower.
Okay.
Like me, right?
Okay.
Oh.
Anyway, so I would like to reflect on what happened in Indonesia back in 1974. There is a big riot against Japanese investment. At that time, there's a prime minister from Japan coming to Indonesia, and then there's a big protest against the Japanese investment. So, but after that, shortly after that, Japan also initiate cultural diplomacy through Japan Foundation. So in your case, did you also research about the spending that by the Japanese government in order to make a nice diplomacy from their side, so they're not looking into as a economic animal, instead become a high culture human and then more civilized than the other counterpart, which is Asia. Did you also compare that and then maybe give a perspective on that as well?
Great, many thanks. I know we have some more questions, but let's get some responses first from our speakers and then have a second round of questions. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So I was just going to pick up. Did you want to go?
I don't know. I feel that a lot of questions were directed at me.
Should we just go in order?
Why don't I answer the questions and, you know, if there's anything I...
Let me go first.
Okay.
Let me
go first. We're gonna work our way back towards
the... Yes. So I just want to come on the question that you raised about can Japan and the East Asian economies do anything together. I think there are a lot of assumptions there that you put the Japan and the East Asian economies are somehow ideologically or in other ways counter to China. And I would question that. In the sense that China and Japan recently signed a third-party agreement that they would do third-party financing in another country together. I think this is a good way forward because it helps Japan to then work with China to push up standards. That's more useful than them acting in competition against China, which then is a more adversarial relationship. But I think the link to human rights is friendly because it goes to your point, Japan is superb at soft power. But the idea somehow that Japan is a human rights champion is very easy to disprove because you just have to look at what they did during the Rohingya crisis, which is not really that much at all. And that's because of their close political relationship with the Myanmar military, long-standing historical relationship. So I think to group countries together to suggest that they somehow represent a different set of values to China in the case of Japan doesn't quite neatly work. So I think it's better that... You know, I think initiatives like this third-party financing agreement is better because through cooperation you can drive better standards. That's not to say, and Japan does stand up against China and is very vocal on maintaining the rules-based order, but if you look at it through a human rights lens, there's lots to criticize Japan on. I think on the ASEAN point, you know, protecting the... I can't remember who asked the question around protecting the interests of smaller states. I'm not sure that I feel so generously about ASEAN because I think it's a forum of self-interest. And the idea somehow that they would have the negotiating capacities to not think about what's best for them, but to think about what's best for the collective, or the institutionalization of those negotiating capacities. So what would be the bodies or the instruments or the tools where they genuinely speak with a collective voice, not a consensus voice, is lacking. So I think that's how you will always have this issue, that when it really comes against the rub with really difficult issues, whether that's economic or conflict-related stuff, everybody retreats back to their own corners. You know, it's funny, I think people are very short-minded on Japan because they forget that the US-Japan had a trade dispute in the 1980s. Exactly what we're seeing with China now, because the US saw Japan as its great big economic competitor. So in a way, the US tends to repeat itself when it feels like somebody is challenging its hegemony. But at the same time, what Japan was very adept at doing, as you say, like if you look at those anti-Japanese riots, is that they've invested a lot of money, time, into developing their soft power, which is why I find it interesting that we overlook Japan so much when we're looking at sort of Chinese economic power, Asian economic powers and their engagement in the rest of the world. The Japanese are also investing heavily in Africa, in the Middle East. Everywhere China is, Japan is. And I think we could glean a lot from doing a more comparative analysis. Really, where are they differing? And are there opportunities, based on what Japan has learned from its own experiences, that can help drive up standards elsewhere?
I will go sequentially. And to the first question to King's College, right? Anna from King's College, right? Next door. So, okay, if I understand you correctly, is that Japan should be more involved in protecting Southeast Asia, human rights and stuff like that. And should it be more assertive and stuff like that? Yes. I have a lot of Japanese friends, and you know, I have to say this very carefully, is that, look, Japan is leading, but Japan likes to lead very quietly behind the doors. They don't like to go around and, you know, telling people what to do. I don't think that's what the Japanese like to do. But they have their clout. The Asian Development Bank is essentially run by people from Todai, right? The University of Tokyo. And, you know, that controls development funding in my part of the world. We have to realize that, you know, you have the AIIB, yes, but ADB is still going to be there for a long time, right? They pay very good wages, good benefits and stuff like that. People want to work for the ADB, right? And I applied for it once, but didn't get it, okay. And, you know, and you put that aside, if you look at leadership, right, just look at tech leadership. Most of the people in this room would have Japanese cars, yes? Yeah. You still buy a Toyota, right? You still buy a Honda, right? If you are from Vietnam, chances are you would have ridden on this Honda before. Honda Wave, to be exact. So it has command of leadership, right? It does not have a handphone, brand name handphone, but it controls component, your LCDs, made by Sharp, right? So they control certain parts of the value chain. You may not see this, but they do have control of it. And you know, you don't have to go around and say, hey, I am the leader. You know, it doesn't work. I don't think it works like that. And now they have the free and open Indo-Pacific thing, which theoretically allows Japan to take on a bigger leadership if it does not already has. So yeah. And the other thing from the gentleman from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is that, yes, a small increase means a lot. It does. We agree with that. And part of the reason is I grew up in the 80s, Malaysia was the darling of foreign investors those days. We felt that we were the next Singapore. It meant a lot to us. The Thais thought that they were the next Japan. That was really how we felt, right? And yes, it meant a lot, but what we made a mistake collectively, old Southeast Asia, was that we took $1 for $1. And that's not right, because $1 in manufacturing is probably going to be more beneficial than $1 in speculative real estate, simply because manufacturing, it tends to be more linked to the broader economy. You have upstream linkages and, you know, backstream linkages. Very Albert Hirschman stuff, right? You don't have that in real estate. Once the project gets completed, it gets completed, it gets sold. That's it. And you know, we are learning from history, right? So that's why, you know, I keep harping on the manufacturing part. And no country has ever gotten rich without a strong manufacturing sector. That's a reality, you know. I wish I could rewrite history. And the other question was China as a dragon. And why doesn't it invest more in EU and USA, yes? Yes, it does. It does invest quite a bit. But most of the money goes to Hong Kong and Singapore first. So there's no way we can really account for that, yeah. But some money has gone to the States and EU. Rover was acquired by the Chinese some years ago, if I'm not wrong. And PRC-USA trade war, yes? Look, it's hard to differentiate because the figures are figures. And $1 out from China, it could be Toshiba China from Chongqing. It could be GE China. So we can't really tell. But for the small Southeast Asian nations, this is a golden opportunity. We may benefit. Yeah, we may, if we are lucky enough. And, you know, fundamentally, I think the reason why we are seeing this is because Chinese firms, they don't have technology. They don't. They have, at best, upper-mid technology, right? And for that, you know, I want to challenge the floor. Name me one Chinese good you would gladly bring home and show off to your friend. One brand name good. One, just one. Ah, no, Xiaomi is cheap. No, it's not good for showing off, right?
Maybe in his house.
No, come on, no. You don't want to bring Xiaomi home. Really, you know, there's none. You know, if I had a Grand Seiko, a watch from Japan, yes, I would show off. Right? You don't actually have that for Chinese goods. And that's not because of lack of trying. Then that's because the world has changed so much. The product curve has shortened so much that, you know, Japan had 50 or 60 years to build a steel industry, Nippon Steel. China had so much less time to do it. The world is not a kind place. It is not. Perhaps, yeah, I probably talked so much. Right?
Did you have any?
Only just to mention, I think it was a year ago, year and a half ago, that China put limitations on the export of currency for real estate investment abroad. So that line is going to go down. Just to comment.
Okay, let's take some more questions. I'm going to tack one on myself in the end, but we're here and then in the front and over there.
Hi, I'm Cheyenne. I'm a year two student at LSE. I just have two straightforward questions. The first is, how do you foresee China's responses to the worsening optics of its BRI projects? Are they going to adjust their existing strategies, and if so, how? And the second question is, I think based off what Dr. Lim mentioned in terms of US TNC having an asymmetric advantage, like the first mover stuff that he talked about, do you foresee Chinese firms being able to catch up, and how successful will they be in catching up? Thank you.
Up front.
Hi, my name is Farva. I'm a research fellow at the University of Manchester. One of the things that I work on is the China-Pakistan economic corridor. And I really appreciated all your comments. So now that everyone's asked questions, I have more of a comment slash question, I suppose. First of all, to Professor Griffith and Dr. Lim, and then building on from Champa's comments, you know, I think there is a need to also discern between ASEAN countries. So when we talk about Laos, I think one of the things that is missed is Laos joined WTO a couple of years ago. And, you know, that means that building up Laos is not, you know, I mean, of course, it's dominated by China in a sense, but also the entry into WTO means a lot of liberalization just happening. So in that sense, you know, it's sort of reminiscent of countries which are opening up. And I suppose we can say the same for Burma. At the same time, in Singapore and in Hong Kong, there is a you know, I mean, with the protests and everything, but there's a history of real estate conglomeration, Chinese capital, and a different kind of financialization. So, yeah, first of all, the need to discern between ASEAN countries, and secondly, the role of ADB. I mean, rightly, I think we have to realize that ADB was at the forefront of liberal regionalization since the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And it did a lot in terms of opening markets and then reshaping them to make ASEAN something else. And then when we speak about China and the BRI right now, we're actually building up on China's role within ADB. In a lot of countries, actually, ADB heads are Chinese professionals now, you know, building on, I suppose, from Japanese leaders. And then again, I think you mentioned Thailand and Malaysia having strong leadership, strong countries, but they have a history of strong leadership, which is not the case maybe with Laos, for example. Mm-hmm. And finally, to Dr. Patel or Champa, sorry.
That's okay.
I just had a question about what are your thoughts on issues of labor in Sri Lanka? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I see in Pakistan is this idea of a demographic shift. And what are your thoughts, also considering these are things which are relevant to Africa as well as Central Asia? Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
And then there's a question right there.
Hi, I'm Charles. I'm a master's student in international relations here at LSE. I spent the last year living in Cambodia, so I kind of think of Southeast Asia in that lens. But I guess I'm curious if we think that looking at China's kind of actions in Southeast Asia, and again, particularly in Cambodia, makes sense through looking at it through a financial lens and through this kind of FDI lens, because I'm thinking about all of the political kind of weight that China has thrown around in the region. When you look, just in the sense of, I think it's 600 million in military aid to Cambodia. Cambodia, according to the Wall Street Journal, is going to give China a military base in the Gulf of Thailand, much like the one Dr. Patel described that the U.S. kind of proposed in Sri Lanka. So I'm just curious if we think looking at it through the FDI financial lens is enough to fully kind of encapsulate the picture and understand kind of fears among Cambodians and those from other countries that China is kind of taking up or buying up the world.
And a last question in the back over there on the left.
Good afternoon. My name is Grace from the LSE Government Department. I think the domestic sentiment in Southeast Asia has very much bought into the paranoia that you described regarding Chinese investment. So how do you foresee Southeast Asian governments choosing to respond to such less than optimum public opinion with regards to the BRI? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just going to abuse my chair's privilege and make one comment and then ask a question. My comment is it seems to me quite impressive and, for me, enjoyable to hear so much attention focused on Japan, not only in the context of a panel that's ostensibly focused on the BRI and China, but also in a country where people systematically obscure and ignore Japan. No one in this country really pays any attention to Japan. It is, after all, an island country incorporated into the American security umbrella. It once had an empire, it no longer does. It still has a curious conservative culture. People like to drink tea. It's, you know, it's got a lot that rings a bell that people don't want to think about. So I think there's a huge blind spot in this country about Japan. People care about. And one of the interesting things in terms of the pathologizing of China's role in Southeast Asia that you can see is this notion that its interest in infrastructure is driven by politics and that it's somehow predatory and draws people into a trap. And it's worth recalling that Japan's investment in Southeast Asia began through the war reparations agreements that the U.S. government purposefully nudged Japan to establish, not only with various Southeast Asian governments, but with various Southeast Asian politicians, to establish relationships of dependence and interdependence that would work for the American effort to expand Japan into a region of the world to make both Japan and Southeast Asia safe for American empire. And it's also worth noting that the Japanese sales of automobiles and production of automobiles and of motorcycles created addictions to a car-centered, private vehicle-centered mode of transport that actually prevented further public interest and public investment in public transport throughout the region. So actually, Japan has played an important and arguably very problematic political and economic role in Southeast Asia's transport infrastructure history for a number of decades that people otherwise ignore. Here's my question. Professor Griffiths, I'm curious in terms of your interest in and emphasis on the maritime dimensions of connectivity in terms of China's role in shipbuilding. It's an industry where both Japan and South Korea have been very strongly represented, but where Chinese companies, supposedly with enormous support and subsidy from the state, have moved in and sort of encroached on, you know, market shares and expanded their role in global shipbuildings, arguably at the expense of Japanese and South Korean companies, especially the weaker companies. Is this something that you see as important and as having an impact on the region? Okay, let's get some responses, and we need to be done in 5 minutes, so short and snappy.
Me first?
Yeah.
You first. China's role is a shipbuilder. China is now the largest shipbuilder in the world in terms of tonnage. If you look at the value of the ships that it builds the bulkers, it builds the cheapest ships, single-hull bulk transport. The container ships, the most expensive ships in the world, the liquid natural gas ships, they're built in Korea. Mm. If you weight China's gross tonnage to the relative value, then it's probably still only two-thirds that of Korea, which is in the second place. Japan is in third place. Japan also at the higher end of the shipbuilding market. So basically, if you want to build and use up steel, then you use up a lot of steel on the Chinese ships, but they're lower value. And the higher up you go, the more it's in Korea and Japan
at the moment. So it's more complementarity than competition?
I think it's competition, but you lose the lower value-added end of the market, and you concentrate at the higher value-added end. It doesn't mean to say that China isn't shifting. It's shifting. It's just signed a contract for 10 LNG vessels with the Russians, jointly funded. I don't know where the technology, though, will come from. It could well be that the major bits of the liquefied natural gas will come from Korea anyway, but that's shifting. But it's not significant yet. But the it's basically at the bottom end of the market.
Interesting.
Thanks.
Okay. I'll address Cheyenne, right? Your question first. How is China adjusting? By China, you mean basically the firm and the bureaucracy, yes? I think one thing that we don't give a lot of credit to the Chinese bureaucracy and the Chinese firms is that they learn very fast. You know, they wouldn't say outright that, hey, I messed up, right? They're not going to say that. But I think they learn very fast. If you look at the BRI 2.0 recently, the message has changed a lot from the first one, right? It's not so top-down, yeah. Right? It seems to have this more human element, right? And I think slowly you get better, just like the Japanese did in the 80s, the Endaka, right? You learn, right? And now you have Chinese think tanks and all those. So they are learning, but perhaps not in a very loud way. They are learning. But how much can you learn? I can't comment on that, right? And the other thing, yes, Western Japanese TNCs, they still have asymmetrical advantages. And, you know, the Chinese firms, they can catch up. But so far, the evidences suggest, I have to add that I have my co-author for most projects is an applied statistician. So, you know, I get him to run the numbers. I interpret it, right? So is that, yes, they can catch up, but only in certain industries. So far, Chinese firms is very good in mid-tech industries or even upper-mid. So you see dominance in shipbuilding, steel, solar panels, even some wind turbines. So these are the industries that the Chinese seem to be very good at, which are really quite mature industries. You're not really cutting-edge ones, right? Huawei, not really. I don't think, you know, China has problem doing semiconductor, you know, wafers. You know, you don't cut enough, you know. People don't realize that China has a huge trade deficit with Malaysia in wafers, right? Because you produce so many end products, right? You have to buy it from somewhere else. So, you know, that's a thing that China doesn't really have. And I don't want to answer ADB question. About Grace question, right? About how does ASEAN react to uncertainty, yes?
How would Southeast Asian governments react to
We deal with it just like how we deal with most things. Life goes on, you know. Life really goes on. No, I mean, it's true, right? I mean, look, like it or not, you take away the sensitive issues like South China Sea, the Chinese, they are here to stay. And, you know, we are resilient people in the sense that maybe Zai Maoni will not be too happy with this. But the thing is, we are resilient people. Before the Chinese came, we were playing with General Electric's, Mitsubishi, Mitsui, BAE. We're playing with Western money, Japanese money. What makes you think that we can't play with Chinese money?
Let's I have the last word, but the clock is ticking.
It's hard to know how to follow that. Yeah, I completely agree. You can't look at just FDI alone. You have to look at the political dynamics. So if you look at Habentota Port, which a lot has been made about, obviously that is a strategic port for China because it gives it a refueling stop or a stop in the Indian Ocean. But also what many people may not know is that it was offered to the Indians first, who said no to it. So they only went to the Chinese after the Indians said no. And now the Indians are up in arms because, oh no, Habentota, dual use port, etc. And the Sri Lankan Navy officials that I've spoke with are very happy to keep reminding their Indian colleagues, you had your chance, you said no, tough luck. So I think, yes, you have to also consider the geopolitical and geostrategic aspects of it. But it's never, you know, it's how do you scratch behind the headlines to find out what else is going on there? And for India, it could develop its own ports. Why would it invest in Sri Lanka? And through that, the law of unintended consequences, it was then gifted to China, if you want to call it gifted. On labor, there's so much stuff that we can talk about because there's this narrative that Chinese labor comes in, it displaces local labor. In Sri Lanka, there's a local labor shortage because people prefer to go out. So you have a large number of outward migration to work in the Gulf, to work in India because of better wages. So there's a wage differential between Chinese workers and Sri Lankan workers in Sri Lanka. But you also have a labor shortage. The Chinese workers also, even if people don't want to leave Sri Lanka, they'd rather work, for example, on tuk-tuks because they have more freedom and flexibility than on Chinese projects where there's that kind of much more discipline needed and, you know, finishing projects on time, etc. So I think there's a whole range of things around labor. But I would say this, I'm a product of diaspora. I'm sure other people, most of the large percentage of the population in Southeast Asia is of Indian or Chinese descent. So I think you do get demographic changes. The stories of interracial marriages, inter-ethnic marriages in Balochistan and other places, but maybe they're the diasporas of the future. Who knows, right? Whether these are retaining communities, whether they're settler communities, but in a way, that is the history of Asia, which is that migratory story, that in a way, China is not doing something that hasn't always happened within Asia for a long, long time, and we are people who are all products of that, right?
One quick word, but we're running over time.
Yeah, I just want, about this China use of ports, the World Bank is putting forward a model of public-private partnership that's built on BOT, Build, Operate, Transfer. Many of these big infrastructural projects by China or anybody else usually have a 20, 30, 40-year operating clause and then is given over to the government. The same with Gada, the same with Habentota. It's not unusual. You have to question the length of it, yeah, and the use of it. The other thing is there are 730 military bases of America abroad. There's only one at the moment of China and in Africa, and one possibly coming. So I think there's plenty of scope to beat them up if we have to.
Nice note to end on. Many thanks for a really interesting, lively discussion for our three speakers and for the audience. Let's give great thanks.